It's out of here! Home run, Lenny Dykstra!
Stairs rips one into the night, deep into right, way out of here.
The Phillies win the game on a base hit by Mitch Williams at 4:40 in the morning.
Swing and a miss, struck him out. It's wacky, wonderful. Bunch of throwbacks has won the National League pennant.
Welcome to another episode of Continued Success. I am Justin Clue, the head guy at The Good Fight. With me is Liz Rocher of Yahoo Sports. We're going to talk some Phillies. We're going to talk some baseball. Liz, how are you?
I'm good. Welcome back to the world. We took last week off because Justin was on vacation. Now we're back together here talking to you.
You know, every other year or so, I revert to this West Coast scumbag version of myself that I thought I could assume when I was in my early to mid 20s. I was out on the West Coast a lot. I lived on the West Coast for a little bit. And I basically just tried to become one of those scumbags. So, you know, I wear a lot of flip flops. My beard gets really scraggly. Depending on which part of the West Coast I'm in, I do a lot of flannel. I dabble in trucker hats, eat a lot of burritos. So, like, you know, I just kind of channel into that part of my being. But like all of us from the Philadelphia area, I eventually succumbed to the infection of being from Philadelphia and returned here to start taking my life seriously. But yeah, every couple of years I need a respite where I just revert to that form, and it's disgusting. And I appreciate everyone's patience in allowing me to do so. It feels like you guys covered the Phillies pretty adequately while I was gone anyway. Getting snippets of what was going on with the Phillies was interesting, because you would have guessed, just based on snippets alone, that things were going pretty terribly. Typically around that 10-8 Nationals loss that stopped it from being a sweep of the Nationals. But that's my point, that it kept it from being a sweep of the Nationals. It didn't cost
the
Phillies
that I was at.
It didn't cost them the series or anything really bad.
No,
or
it
too
just
bad.
Cost me a good time with my father and fiance.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't see. I don't know. I don't think that's a column in the standings, but I do.
No. I got to see the Jimmy Rollins retirement thing. We've got two replica rings. I bought, you know, like four shirts. They had the Phillies pride shirt with the rainbow Liberty Bell on the front. They had a bunch of those for like $10, so we bought like two.
That's a good. That was a good pride shirt, right? If I'm remembering that one correctly, it was like they've made some stinkers, but that was one of the winners.
Yeah, I thought that was a nice one. It was really simple and cool. And it was like double XL. I tend to buy the 2XL Philly shirts and wear them as like night shirts. I have a Brad Lidge shirt that's approaching 10 years old.
Well, now you have a formal dress to wear to events.
I do. Actually, I wore my Lidge for a Halloween thing at my old job when I was maybe a year into my old job and everything was still fun. Long time ago, I wore for like a Halloween thing that we were doing. I wore the Philly, like the Lidge shirt and a pair of red leggings and like a belt. And I'm like, this is my Halloween costume.
Don't I look weird? Don't ask what I am.
What are you? No, don't ask.
But I'm nothing. It was interesting observing this team from a couple thousand miles away and only with one eye open. So when I came back and the Phillies were alone in first place, and they are still alone in first place, they didn't play last night. They're up what, 3.5 games in the NL East? They're the only NL East team with a positive run differential, it was pointed out yesterday. Four games up on the Braves, 4.5 up on the Mets, and 6.5 up on the Nationals. And you are already seeing woe is me columns out of the Washington camp. I got to tell you, this four-team division that we imagined going into the season has been not disappointing, just kind of underwhelming, I guess is the term. And if you would have told me that only one of those teams would look like the version of themselves that we would have expected by now, I'm not sure I would have picked it to be the Phillies, but they, like I said, they're six games over 500, the only over 20 game winner in the NL East after 36 games. And these other teams all have very clear struggles that that are hampering them. And we're going to get into that for a little bit, get some quote unquote experts' opinions. But first, I wanted to start with us, Liz, and just talk about I believe that the Phillies have played a very sizable number of in-division games. The other three teams I mentioned, and, you know, the Marlins, who have 10 wins, have not done as significant a number of NL East playing. So the Phillies have actually been tested more so against the division, I believe, than some of their other rivals. But in either case, I mean, you know, we've talked about this a lot this year, which team you're most scared of, which team you're least scared of, how many players on the Mets are going to get buckets stuck on their heads after they trip and fall while working on like a cartoon farm. You know, at this point, we're about halfway through May. We're about to be a month and a half into the season. And we probably have a clearer idea of who the Phillies are and who their rivals are. But as we let's phrase it this way. Every one of these teams has a weakness, at least one weakness, and every one of these teams has at least one strength. Whose strength is most likely to overcome their weakness, if I can phrase it as complicated as that?
I would say I still think it's probably the Nationals.
Really? See, I'm ready to count them out. I'm ready.
I'm not. They have a lot of talent on their team, and I don't know what's happening. I think part of it is that Davey Martinez sucks out loud.
Yeah.
He is bad at his job. He's been bad at his job since the beginning. He didn't replace Dusty Baker directly. He replaced...
Was it...
No, did he? He did. I'm just trying to remember. They haven't had a coach last more than two seasons, I don't think.
Yeah, they've had a hard time having long-term success at the management position, except in the case of Dusty Baker, which is interesting because he achieved so much success and was
fired for no reason. Unceremoniously
fired. It was Dusty Baker before Dave Martinez. Before Baker was the Matt Williams year.
It was Matt Williams, who allowed his clubhouse to get so discontented that Jonathan Papelbon strangled Bryce Harper in the dugout.
So
I will find any excuse to talk about that.
We talk about the Nationals becoming a dominant figure in this division around 2012. Davey Johnson takes over the Nationals in 2011, and that era is basically underway for managers. Since 2012, the Nationals have had four different managers. Three of them, excluding only their current manager, who Dave Martinez, three of them won the NL East at least once. Two of them won NL Manager of the Year. And yet, like I said, there have been four of them since 2011. So there's been a very short, very cartoonishly short leash on every one of these guys, from Davey Johnson to Matt Williams to Dusty Baker. And now it sounds like to Dave Martinez. Now, Matt Williams, you know, yeah, I'm not saying it wasn't necessarily... You could make the argument that it was deserved that they eventually lost their jobs. Things got bad. It was the right move. Culture shakeup, blah, blah, blah. But again, this has to be the team that's gone through the most success and yet the most, like, the highest number of managers for the most amount of success. Like, that can't not be true. I don't know how you'd quantify that, but it can't not be true. There's four division titles among these three past managers and two managers of the year. And they still couldn't get them past the first round of the playoffs. I do feel like this podcast quickly turns into the Nationals bashing podcast every time we talk, really. And I do think that's fine. But looking at it now, I mean, that's just, that floors you, and that they're about to go through this again. They already fired their pitching coach, which was just sort of the warning shot of like, all right, Dave, after this, kind of nobody else we can fire, in even a ceremonial gesture towards fixing the team. You know, one scout said the NL East is going to come down to whoever fixes their bullpen first. Obviously, beyond Kimbrel, he's just one man. I'm not sure how you would do that. The Nationals have the worst bullpen of any major league team, let alone in the NL East. So, Yeah, that's why I kind of disagree. And I feel like when you can't diagnose the problem, it becomes even harder to solve. And I feel like we, you know, maybe it's not that we didn't know what the problem was when we were watching these terrible Phillies teams the past couple of years, but it was just so everywhere. And so, you know, it was based on low skill level of the players, but also bad luck. Because you're right, there are good players on the Nationals. There were good players on a couple of these bad Phillies teams, but they just together, they weren't as good. They were missing a piece. They were missing several pieces. They were able to hit, but then they couldn't field one night. Obviously, if you have a terrible bullpen, that's going to weigh you down a great deal, because especially in 2019, you're not going to be able to rely on every starter going deep in a game every game. That's why I'm kind of counting them out at this point. Like, I'm sure we'll see some surges of life from them, and we'll get a few of those "these guys never say die" narratives later in the season, because I don't know any other baseball writers who love the team they cover more so than Nationals writers, but at the same time, I think this is widespread enough. It's abstract enough that if they're talking about firing the manager in early May, that's not going to be the cure-all they need it to be. Unless the only thing they could do managerially is go back in time and not fire Dusty Baker, and it's too late for that. They're not going to be able to replace Dave Martinez with somebody who's going to save this season. Like, it might be somebody who turns them around, puts them all in better moods, but I don't know. I feel like that's the team that that might be out of it this season. And maybe not. I'm not saying it's like the end of them for this era, but it would make sense if it was. But I think this year it's going to be too much turmoil. It's too much drama. They're not going to be able to get in sync with each other. You know,
when you talk about firing a manager, usually it's because things are going so badly, you need to stop the bleeding. Mm-hmm. It's not to turn things around. Like, when you fire a manager mid-season, you're right. You just get in someone who makes everyone feel good. Like, they've also been historically reluctant to spend any money on managing. Like, Dusty Baker took a pay cut. He took a drastic pay cut to work for the Nationals. They wouldn't give him a lot. They didn't get Bud Black, who is now managing the Rockies. He didn't get Bud Black Bud Black wouldn't accept a pay cut from his last job, or at least that drastic a pay cut. You know, they're skimpy on both money and years, and that's a huge problem, because that means they're just not going to get any real superstars. Like, Joe Girardi might kind of look like he has a stick up his ass all the time, but he's a good manager. He got the best out of his team. He got the best out of his team for years, because, you know, the Yankees had some bad years, but they also had some competitive years when maybe they shouldn't have. You know, they had a lot of young talent. They looked like crap for a while there. Like, I had no idea how they were getting so much, you know, out of their roster. But Joe Girardi isn't going to take a pay cut. He knows what he's worth. You know, in a lot of ways, teams are trying to do the same thing to the managers as they are to the players. Like, you got to pay talent in order for them to want to work for you.
Wouldn't the Nationals' job be pretty desirable if you were a managing contender, even without Bryce Harper? Like, I know the narrative would say, like, okay, well, now they're on the down, but everybody pretty much maintained that even without Bryce
Patrick
Harper,
Corbin, this is Juan Soto,
yeah, this is a good team.
Max Scherzer, a bunch of Anthony Rendon, who wants to who I think they're trying to sign to an extension.
Victor Robles, I mean,
yeah, like, you can't let Anthony Rendon hit the open market if you're the Nationals and you want to keep competing. You can't. But I think they are, because they don't want to spend any money. They're obsessed. You could see it in their deferred money.
Yeah.
And they've got at least two, if not three, contracts right now, big contracts with deferred money. And, you know, you wonder why Bryce Harper didn't want to sign there if his contract wouldn't be fully paid out till 2072, and I'm not making up that number.
Oh yeah, I mean, that was ridiculous. That was a laughable level of respect. Yeah, offering him money that he can't get for the next couple decades.
50 years. Like, the Nationals, the learners, the owners, these are the same people who wouldn't spend a couple $100,000 to keep the Metro open in DC so people at the playoff game could get home.
Yeah, that and the I mean, Ken Rosenthal was talking about which managers were in trouble this early in the season. And he talked about Clint Hurdle in Pittsburgh. He talked about Aaron Boone in New York. But obviously, Dave Martinez led the field in that category. But he also brought up, he wanted to put some blame on Mike Rizzo, the GM, for assembling that bullpen, because obviously Martinez didn't build the bullpen. He just has to use it to try and win baseball games, which is a tall order. When one of your more central relievers has an ERA of infinity for a sizable chunk of the beginning of the season. So, yeah, it's not great. And, I think it's probably premature of me to say that they're out. But I don't know. I feel like we've heard this story before with other teams, and I don't know. I'm kind of done handling the Nationals with kid gloves and just being like, yeah, but they have all these good players. They'll have good players again next year. You know,
I'm so scared of them.
I feel you. Now, so you feel like the Nationals can overcome this beginning? So which of the two remaining competitive teams in the NL East, or maybe even we'll throw the Phillies in there too, which of these teams do you see falling away then?
I don't want to say that it's the Phillies. I would like to imagine that they are consistent, but we know that is not true. We know that they have issues with consistency.
I will
sometimes.
Say, I don't mean regression. And even the Phillies haven't even been so good that you got to be like, oh, they're going to regress to the mean. Like, they're 6 games over .500. They've lost a lot of games they probably should have won. So it's not like they've been blowing people
exactly.
out of the water.
They have. They could definitely falter, and it wouldn't take much. I mean, despite all of this, you know, the Nationals having a tough start, you know, it's still really anybody's game. Like, if the Phillies have a good next stretch, I think they don't play anybody in the NL East for, like, the next month or so. But after that, they play nothing but the NL East for, like, six
yes.
weeks. And if they want to, like, put it away, then they can. If they want to just end it, they could just stick the dagger and be done. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't. I think I'm trying to look up the standings right now, because I think the Mets – are right underneath the Phillies right now. The Braves
are a half a game up on the Mets. The Braves are 18-20. They're four games behind the Phillies. The Mets are 17-20. They're a half a game behind the Braves. And then the Nationals. Nationals are 15-22. 6.5 games out.
The Phillies really are the only team in the NL East
looking
right
pretty
now.
Good. I mean, we've certainly been fooled before. We're wearing our May goggles. It's different, but we can be aware of that and still look at these standings and be like, okay, you know, there were a couple times it didn't feel like the Phillies were going to be in this position even by May 10th, but here we are. So I think we can, you know, not hold our breath, but maybe breathe a sigh of relief for the moment, and then get back into this tonight when the Phillies take on the soft underbelly of the AL Central a little bit in facing the Royals.
Most of the AL Central is soft underbelly, really.
Yes, that's the soft underbelly of baseball. Well, that's what we think about the state of the NL East and the Phillies right now. We're going to get some quote-unquote expert opinions right after we come back from this first break. Well, Liz, after this offseason, I think you and I both have never held anonymous scouts in higher esteem as sources of information. So I figured that would be a terrific source to turn to for further discussion of the NL East. No, I mean, honestly, I kind of debated whether I even wanted to bring this up because, you know, part of the problem, and I'm, of course, referring to that anonymous scout's surmising of Odubel Herrera that got published in Sports Illustrated. That, among other things, has really made you wonder why media outlets turn to anonymous scouts for opinions, because A, there's no accountability. It seems like it's pretty easy to do. I'm kind of thinking that, like, the definition of what is or isn't a scout probably gets bent as well when they're just like, oh, this person is here and connected to this aspect of baseball. I'm just going to get their opinion, call them an anonymous scout, and then, like, run the piece. I feel like that probably happens on occasion as well. Because it's just dumb. These guys, sometimes they just sound like complete idiots, and you're just like, wow, you know, I'm a casual, you know, observer of baseball. I'm not like a professional going to the park every night, breaking down everybody's skill level and pinpoint precision and every part of their motion and everything. And even I feel like I could have had a better, more informed opinion than that. Like, that's asinine. So it's sort of eye opening to learn what scouts are focusing on when they build their opinions on guys. And considering it's their job to have opinions about baseball, sometimes they sound just kind of clueless. that being said, MLB.com's Mark Bowman, who covers the Braves, wrote a piece in which he got quotes from AL and NL scouts on what they did like and what they didn't like about each of the NL East teams. In regards to the Braves, and it's funny, each one of these is just the quote followed by AL scout or NL scout, which, like, honestly, why bother? Like, if we're not using people's names, it doesn't matter what league the scout is in. That, I don't think that's really going to change. I mean, maybe it makes you wonder why. No, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
It's Mark Bowman. At this point, his entire output is why bother.
So, for the Braves, the scouts in question, they liked the Braves lineup, which, you know, any lineup with Freddie Freeman in it is pretty appealing. He liked that there's veterans and young players. Okay, that's a lot of teams. They like Dansby Swanson, and they feel like the offense is strong enough to cover for the pitching. Sounds familiar.
Trenchant analysis. Thank you. Thank you, anonymous.
Yeah, so much good information there. What they didn't like was that the pitching staff wasn't healthy. They needed better from some of the younger guys in the rotation. Again, sounding familiar. And like the overall command, this rotation seems to have struggled throwing strikes. So honestly, when you sum it up like that, the Braves don't sound too different from the Phillies. And yet the Phillies have 21 wins and are in first place, while the Braves are, you know, not. So, I don't know. I mean, I think when the Phillies lineup is hitting, it's probably the best lineup when the Phillies lineup is healthy, it's probably the best lineup in the NL East. Not probably. I think that it is the best lineup in the NL East. And I think that's probably tough to argue with. I mean, you start with Bryce Harper and then kind of move out from there. And it's just a series of like, oh, right, they have that guy, like JT Realmuto and Rhys Hoskins and Gene Segura. I mean, Porter is easily, I think, the most productive when it's healthy. It just, they really hit a skid this early in the season where the Phillies lineup just was not all together at the same time. The Braves, I don't believe, have undergone a serious injury epidemic. Their lineup's been pretty much together for most of the season. So again, like Freddie Freeman and Ronald Acuna and Ozzie Albies, they had a couple of slow starts in Atlanta, but I don't know. I feel like that's probably the team that's most likely to have a power surge. So I think, yeah, the offense could cover for the pitching, but man, if nobody wants to make a move for pitching in the NL East, I'm not sure why no one will make an adjustment. Why shouldn't it be the Braves? I mean, I don't know. Do you think we're omitting anything particularly egregious about the Braves when we talk about them?
I don't think so. I mean, they would be wise to stock up, but I think they showed us that they have no plans to. If it costs money, they're not going to do it. And I'll admit, I don't know where their farm system is and whether they have anyone to trade. But they seem pretty happy with everyone they have. They're probably just going to ride with it, which, fine. I mean, if they want to do that, then it makes them easier for the Phillies to beat. If they just want to continue to be like, no, everything's fine. We're fine. We've done everything we're supposed to do. Like, I was talking with, I think it was Chris Towers of CBS Sports, and he was talking about, you know, the climate in baseball and, you know, the way things have been going with prospects. You know, it's a lot more relevant with the recent story from Jeff Passan about MLB teams signing literal 13-year-olds. But, you know, there's a point where every team taking advantage of this whole rebuilding structure and their ability to get high draft picks and spend no money and make a lot of profit, there's going to be a point where we're starting to have teams that are expected to spend money and they're just laughing in everyone's faces. And the Braves are one of the first teams to do that. They spent some time rebuilding. They promised they were going to do more. And they've said numerous times, we never promised we'd spend money. And like, that's the whole point of this. Like, we, what we promised was financial flexibility, not that we'd use it. Like, fuck you.
And the Braves,
I'm really,
and the Braves fans were all like, oh, you got us. You got, that's technically correct. You didn't say that. So a good natured like, guffaw from Braves fans hearing something like that from their team.
Like, we'll go off topic for just another second, but like, I'm very thrilled and gratified that the Phillies have not done that. They spent years rebuilding. It was bad. We all watched it. And then they went out and spent money. They went out and not just spent money, they made trades. They made hard choices with prospects. You know, especially like Sixto Sanchez was throwing like 98, 99 yesterday. You know, he's back from injury. He's looking good. Like, it's hard to look at that. But they made tough choices that made the team better. They actually kept their promise to their fans because winning is important. There's something to be said for a baseball team being the toy of a billionaire, because then he'll just do what John Middleton did and throw money at it with abandon.
Yeah, I think we're going to look back on this and realize how fortunate we were that the Phillies were one of like three teams that were like, let's make our team better this offseason, in an offseason that was defined by a lot of teams just being like, let's sit here where it's comfortable and just, you know, doing nothing is so much easier than doing something. And very few of them did. Whereas, like you said, not only did the Phillies make some moves, I mean, I remember us lauding the Reds for like doing something to be entertaining. The Phillies, by that comparison, completely revamped. I think they have the most different lineup from last year to this year than probably any team in baseball. And they made themselves so much more watchable and so much more interesting and fun. I think that's, we're going to look back and realize that's one of the biggest assets. But the scouts weren't done talking about NL East teams, obviously, at this point. The Braves, I felt like that's a fair summation. I think basically they're just waiting for the Braves to just show the real Braves. And I think we all are to an extent. The Mets, they said the Mets were the most rounded club in the NL East. They talked about, again, it all depends on how the rotation does. They have Edwin Diaz in the back of the bullpen, so that goes a long way because this is a division full of terrible bullpens. And then, you know, here's something I forgot. Jed Lowry is on the Mets. Didn't know that.
Oh, wow.
He's all injured. Right. Had no recollection of that. But they don't like the Mets defense, especially their infield defense. Jed Lowry, they say, is, quote, just okay at third base. And offensively, they haven't reached their full potential. Pete Alonso would be a awesome player to watch if he wasn't wearing a Mets uniform. That's my opinion. Most well-rounded. Most well-rounded, you know, I don't think that's undeserved. I don't think too highly of their offense, but it has been capable of beating the Phillies. And, you know, Brandon Nimmo has had a slow start, but I know he's a little pain in the ass. Pete Alonso has looked awesome. Jeff McNeil has continued his career as a Philly killer. I think that's fair. I think all you need to do to be well-rounded in the NL East is have an effective bullpen because, you know, passable offense, and then, like the Mets, should have the best rotation by far in the NL East with Noah Syndergaard and Jacob DeGrom, Zach Wheeler, even Steven Matz. And then have Edwin Diaz as your closer. I mean, yeah, I think that's fair to call them the most well-rounded. However, you know, the Mets also have to deal with every onset of Mets-ness that comes their way. And they've had a little bit of that this year, this season too. And they've looked pretty sloppy on occasion as well. So, I don't know, Mets, we kind of just, I don't know what to make of the Mets exactly. They weren't necessarily expected to be a dominant team this year, but I do think, their biggest pain in the ass days of 2019 are still ahead of us. I don't know. I mean, at this point,
for sure,
did you expect the Mets to be better? Because, I've kind of talked myself that as far as pitching goes, it's probably unarguable that they're set up to have the best pitching in the division. Here we are.
I think they're good. I mean, I think that's a pretty fair assessment. I think we are still waiting to find out who they are. I think it's most because the Phillies haven't played them much. Once the Phillies play them more, we'll definitely have a better idea of whether or not we have to be afraid. Once they play another series with them, we'll know, like, oh, no, we don't want this to happen again. I think Robinson Cano is still down, and I'll be honest, I don't know how he was still doing, how he was doing. But I mean, they actually did do stuff to make themselves better. You know, they didn't do a lot, mm-hmm. but they did some stuff. It was all trades, and they extended Jacob deGrom, who for some reason wants to stay there. I'm sure.
And, you know, the Mets, they've been hit a little bit by injury struggles, but that's what scouts are crediting for the Nationals' missteps thus far. And I guess I didn't really mention that before when I was counting them out, but that is something that plays a part in this. Like, yeah, you obviously don't blame a player for getting injured, but when you are in just like quicksand health-wise in regards to your roster and some of the key players on it, that's when it starts to feel like your team struggling is completely outside of your control. Yeah, you know, it's great to think, oh, next man up, you know, this guy got hurt and then this guy really stepped up and it was great. And this team, you know, this is a team. It's not a team of individuals, it's a team of, you know, teammates, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, you know, that happens on occasion, but it doesn't seem like it's happening in Washington. And when you have an injury epidemic that you just can't get out of, among other struggles, and you're Dave Martinez watching that happen, that's what I mean when I say I think they're falling away, because it stops feeling like it's something they can even control when it comes down to getting as hurt as much as key national players have so far this season. And that's what the scouts kind of echoed, that it's tough to really classify the Nationals because it's been hard to see them all together at once. Part of me feels like I haven't watched a Nationals game this year so far where someone hasn't gotten hurt. Well, because
the Phillies have had that problem too. Like, the injury argument can only take you so far.
True. And I wouldn't consider the Phillies a particularly deep team. Yet when you scroll down and look at what scouts like about the Phillies, you know, the bench, they say, you know, they have a decent bench, it was said, which I wasn't ready to call this a decent bench not too long ago. So I might have to disagree with the scouts on there. And that's, you know, that's something, the Phillies' depth was something that we had already talked about this year because they had to tap into it immediately when the entire middle infield went down with injuries. And, you know, they've apparently been able to overcome that. No, nobody, I think, except Tommy Hunter has been on longer than the 10-day injured list, mm-hmm. which is good. But yeah, the Nationals, they've faced similar health problems and they haven't been able to overcome them. And,
yeah, I'm looking at their injury list right now, like who's currently on the injured list, not who might have been. Like, it, we've got three big players: Trey Turner, Juan Soto, Ryan Zimmerman. Those are sort of the biggest names. You know, I think Matt Adams also, but he was playing as recently as last weekend when I saw him play. And so he sort of hasn't quite been a factor, but those three, like Ryan Zimmerman, played 22 games and was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Trey Turner is, you know, and Ryan Zimmerman is not the player that he was. He's not that 300 player. He's more of like a 260, 250 player. Trey Turner is usually very good. He's been out since the beginning, and that's definitely an issue. Juan Soto has been out recently. And so those are sort of the two big things, and missing them is bad, but I don't feel bad at all. I don't, because the Phillies lost Odubel Herrera for a while when he was getting hot. They lost Scott Kingery when he was getting hot. They had to struggle with Cesar Hernandez forgetting how to play baseball for like
Gene
a month.
Gene Segura, that was a big one.
Gene Segura, yes, he does nothing but hit, and he was out. Like, injuries affect every team. Like, the Yankees have been felled by injury, and they're still ahead of the Red Sox and finally gating on the freaking Rays.
I will say, you know, we're talking about depth and how the, you know, when the Phillies had to bump up Phil Gosselin and Sean Rodriguez as bench pieces and middle infielders, based on Scott Kingery and Gene Segura both getting hurt, it was seen as like, okay, yeah, this team could use some more depth. However, I feel like you got to mention that both of those guys, Sean Rodriguez came up from AAA, played in 7 games. Phil Gosselin came up, played in 15 games. Phil Gosselin left the Phillies hitting 300 after 15 games. Sean Rodriguez left the Phillies hitting 316 after 7 games. He had a home run in a game where that was the sole offense that the Phillies lost. But both of those guys, you know, maybe that's the difference when we're talking about guys stepping up. I mean, hey, look, they weren't here very long, but when they were, they put up the kind of numbers, the best, probably the best you could ask for from guys put in that position. Quad A players who didn't make the club out of spring training, who were told, look, go, go, you know, go sit in the microwave and AAA. And if something happens, you're going to get the call. And something happened. They got the call and they came up. And, you know, John Rodriguez is 1066 OPS through 19 at bats, but still. and that's I guess that's that must be the difference in when the Phillies needed replacement players to play at even a productive level to maintain the level of success that, you know, these their starters had put them at. They got it to an extent. They got it. They didn't get nothing, I guess, is the point. And the Nationals, man, they've, speaking of getting nothing, you know, their offense has been what it has. And I think, you know, like the scout said, when they're healthy, that's obviously a formidable lineup. But when you're dragging the worst bullpen in baseball behind you, nothing's going to save you. Sean Doolittle is the only effective arm in that bullpen. And Trevor Rosenthal's looked terrible. They're missing Cody Glover. And nobody else has really been effective, as anyone who's watched the Nationals will tell you. So, yeah, that's kind of where I'm at with the NL East. And I think a lot of these anonymous scouts would agree with me. So that makes me feel really smart, Liz, that these these old men wearing masks, speaking in muffled voices to Major League reporters to remain anonymous. That I have them in my corner. That feels pretty dandy. Well, before we get to our chronicle of the 2009 season this week, Liz, I did have one final question for you. Albert Pujols is 2000 RBI this week. He obviously has had a long career, and as the Angels were destroying the Tigers in Detroit 13-0, he had his 2000th career RBI. It was a home run to left field, and a Tigers fan grab the ball. This was a guy who the way this story was set up, it talks about, the headline talks about how, oh, Pujols hit this 2000th RBI. He wanted the ball. The fan was like, well, I'm going to keep the ball. And you were like, oh, I'm ready to hate this guy. And then you just watch the video of him being interviewed, and he's just like, yeah, no, I mean, like, I just, you know, my brother's a big Cardinals fan. I think this would be a cool present to give to him. Like, Pujols wants to meet with me. I just came out here for a beer and a ball game. Like, he clearly didn't want to make a big deal out of it, but he was also just like, I kind of want to keep this ball and give it to my brother. And Pujols, to his credit, was like, that's fine. He says, I think he can have a great piece of history with him. You know, we play this game for the fans too, so I just hope I hope he can enjoy it. And Pujols also said, you know, I'm not going to pay him for it. I'm not going to pay one penny for that. And you know, it's his 2000th RBI. It's a milestone, but I can see why that's not particularly, you know, I need that baseball. Besides, at this point in Pujols' career, all the baseballs probably just look like baseballs. So I get that. And he was like, yeah, it's fine. So everybody kind of left that amicably, but I wanted to get your opinion. What milestone do you consider to be the threshold for, yes, someone should automatically give the ball back to the player, or that, like, the ball will be desired by the player? And what's, like, on the other side of that, that, like, no, you don't have to. So, like, 2000 RBIs, I can see that not being an automatic, okay, here's the ball, and, like, you get to be admired for being a good person for just giving it back to him, or the team has to do something like, here's some season tickets or whatever. Thank you for the baseball. So, like, what's the stat to you? Like, does that be home runs or hits or what is it?
I don't think any fan is under any obligation to give a ball back ever if they don't want to. I don't. Like, if their intention is to sell it, I'd say let the team, quote unquote, buy it from you. Mm-hmm. You know, if what they want to do is let it hit the open market or whatever, then, you know, that if you want to sell it, let the team or the player buy it from you, and they will. They'll do it in money. They'll do it in stuff. Like, teams and like these, they have a lot of money, and if they want something, they'll get it. But otherwise, like, if you want to keep it, if you want to give it to a friend who loves that team or whatever, you are at no point are you under any obligation to give it back. And I don't think a team has ever tried to take a ball from someone who hasn't wanted it back.
Can you imagine?
I can't. Like, if something leaves the field of play, it no longer belongs to the team. Mm-hmm. Like, it belongs to the person who caught it. No one should ever feel like they have to give something back, you know? And if someone wants it, then they can pay top dollar for it.
Yeah, I feel like I'm at a point now where I've never been I'm gonna say I've never been more frustrated, but that makes it sound like I like wake up frustrated at Major League Baseball and its, and its teams. It's more just like I'm dismissive of them. I expect just ignorance, cowardice, just idiocy by and large, the majority of the time from Major League Baseball as a collective. And then like when you're dealing with teams when they're at their most businesslike and when they're at their, when they're least operating like, you know, like baseball teams. But it's the interaction with the players that I think matter more, because that's the part of baseball we actually care about and want. So it's like, yeah, if the team, as far as like keeping it from the team, I'm all in favor of that. Like the team shouldn't just get what it wants because it wants it. And this is the one time where a fan would, you know, theoretically have leverage over a team. But if an individual player was like, hey, that would really mean something to me, you know, obviously kind of depends on the player. But for the most part, you know, especially somebody like Pujols, who was like a cool player, who has always seemed like he gets it. And I was obviously one of the best hitters of a generation. If he was like, hey, you know, I'd really like that ball. You know, I'm obviously prepared to compensate you for it. If that's what we're doing here. I'm more likely to hand it over to an individual player requesting it than a team to be like, hey, we're sending down an envoy to negotiate with you. It's like, yeah, you know what? I paid $30 plus $18 in fees to get in here today, plus $20 to park, plus $50 in concessions. I'm keeping this ball. This ball is mine. And I got a pretty nice gift for my brother. So, yeah, I think I'm kind of there at that point with balls entering the field or leaving the field of play. That being said, we're going to go to our second break and talk about what was going on with the 2009 Phils when we're back. Well, Liz, we talked about the 2009 Phillies finding their groove in late April in our last episode, but in truth, they weren't done squabbling. Early May saw them lose a few winnable games before catching fire again in the month's second half. So that late April outburst was more of a preview than a full turnaround. I know you'll be surprised to hear that. Baseball seasons go up and down. Who would have thought?
And down. And down.
But I just remind people what we do on this podcast. Last year, we chronicled the 2008-1993 seasons as they were both celebrating anniversaries. This year, we've decided to talk about what was going on with the 2009 Phillies as the season goes on, just to acknowledge the 10-year anniversary of their World Series run as well. And in early May, you know, a lot of these teams struggled at the beginning of the season. I think, you know, everybody got all hot and bothered by how good the team was in general from 2007 to 2011. I do think that 2011 team is a bit of an outlier in that regard. They didn't lose a whole lot and were pretty much dominant the whole season until the very end. But a lot of these teams, you know, everybody was all hot and bothered by their deep playoff runs by opening day. And then the team would typically come out looking kind of flat.
Yep.
So this team was no exception, but by now they had won a couple of games. May started with a 7-4 loss to the Mets at home, for which you could fairly blame Chan Ho Park's bad start and Greg Dobbs's base running blunder. Jimmy Rollins was picked off first by Mike Pelfrey early on, but while down 7-3, the Phillies had two runners on base when Chris Coast rounded third, then came back to third as Dobbs had already barreled around second base towards third, unaware that Coast had stopped, and he was tagged out. So what was supposed to be a bases loaded, no out situation was now two runners on with two outs. The Phillies didn't score, and while that sucked, Charlie Manuel showed some uncharacteristic job insecurity for Chan Ho Park, indicating that the starting pitching had to get better and that the Phillies would, quote, do things to make it better. So this is complete contrast. Ominous. Yeah, I mean, that's complete contrast to what we've talked about as far as Brad Lidge or Cole Hamels. And, you know, I was thinking about this yesterday. That's been a talking point for us in this regard a bunch of times, that Brad Lidge and Cole Hamels both struggled so much in 2009 and never really found their grooves. And yet they never really lost their jobs. And, you know, it was frustrating at the time to be like, OK, no, we're going to see Lidge again. We're going to see Lidge again. We're going to see Lidge again. But at the same time, and I feel like we've hit on this, but it just kind of resonated a little more thinking about how key. Hey, we're talking about Brad Lidge, the guy who won the Phillies the World Series in 2008, and Cole Hamels, their mm-hmm. World Series MVP from 2008. If these guys didn't get all the leeway in the world, something would be wrong, especially in Charlie Manuel's clubhouse, a guy who's going to have the most faith in you when you get him to the top of the sport. I think he's going to at least give you a full season of complete faith. Chan Ho Park hadn't earned that. He was not somebody who had been with the team for the 2008. He was the fifth starter who won his job out of spring training. So it's not completely mind blowing to see Charlie Manuel speaking. So, I mean, for him to say something as devastating as do things to make it better, that's basically the kiss of death from Charlie Manuel based on how ambiguously he would talk and how typically he would do nothing but assure you of his faith in his players. I don't remember. He obviously didn't talk down about too many of his players publicly, but I don't know. Do you think Chan Ho Park was obviously not long for this world as a Phillies starter? I don't know, do you think Charlie Manuel was being overly negative by saying, oh, we're going to do some things to make it better in early May in regards to the rotation?
No. I mean, it's like the least of all, you know, that's as harsh as Charlie gets. I mean, he can't get, you know, angrier, but like that's kind of, that's like the edge of Charlie right there.
Right.
You know, we're going to do things to make it better. No specifics. Sounds vaguely ominous. You know, but it's not like Chan Ho Park didn't deserve it.
Right. And it's not like Charlie Manuel even really ran the pitching staff. He kind of just handed all that to Rich Doobie. And Rich Doobie was like, this is what we're going to do. So people turned to Rich Doobie, who more often than not was giving you the quotes you wanted in 2009. And he was basically like, look, we haven't had that conversation, but Charlie will let me know when he wants to have that conversation. And sounded like
I'm ready with a whole list of things.
Exactly. And I think Charlie was this was an indication that he was nearing his ready point to have that conversation. And understandably so, the Phillies were on the verge of dropping two to the Mets to start the month of May. They played a series of little couplets to start the month. They played the Mets twice, they played the Cardinals twice, they played the Mets twice again. Part of that was due to a rain postponement, as we're going to say. They weren't sticking around too long in any particular city to start the month. On May 2nd, thanks to a three-run Mets rally that took the lead in the fifth on two home runs off Jamie Moyer by Daniel Murphy and Ramon Castro, the Phillies were looking to drop that second game to the Mets to start the month. Fortunately, recent acquisition and legendary folk hero Raul Ibanez tied the game with a home run in the sixth, and Shane Victorino worked a heroic bases-loaded walk to walk it off in the bottom of the ninth. But like I said, thanks to a rain postponement, Cole Hamels had his next start pushed back, even though, according to reporters, he was walking just fine through the locker room. Obviously, that's different than playing in a game and putting a bunch of pressure on his ankle, which, as we talked about in our last episode, Cole Hamels was both hit by a Prince Fielder line drive and suffered a mild left ankle sprain at this point. So he was all beat up. People were waiting for him to turn it around, as well as the rest of the rotation. There was no one in the rotation that they could really rely on to give them a solid start at this point, including Cole Hamels. So I think by default, all eyes turned to him and was just like, all right, look, please, you know, we need you to be a stopper. If you're not stopping anyone, no one's going to stop anyone at this point. So fortunately, the Phillies managed to salvage one of those two games in New York. Cole Hamels had his next start naturally pushed back. The Phillies didn't have to hold him back. He got to just miss it thanks to a rain postponement and get some more rest. So, the Phillies were just kind of left with hoping the pitching worked itself out as they went to play the Cardinals, always a fun team to play. St. Louis had the best record in baseball at this point, so not easy for anybody to play against, let alone a team like the Phillies that was still trying to jam the batteries in the right way to make its pitching work. It worked well enough in game one of the two games against the Cardinals when Joe Blanton used his fresh new slider to beat them 6-1 and work his season RA down to a nice, smooth 684. Liz, you know, in talking and researching and remembering all this about the 2009 Phillies and even about the 2008 and 93 Phillies last season, I have to ask, has any pitching staff ever been good?
No.
I didn't think so, you know?
No pitching staff, no bullpen. They're all right. Bad. Like, I was talking about this with, I think, the dudes over at the Philadelphia Sports Table podcast. I was on their fine podcast this week. And we were talking about the bullpen. And I'm just like, every team's bullpen is a problem. Every single right. team. The only team's bullpen that hasn't been a problem was the Cleveland Indians back in 2016. Their bullpen was not a problem, and yet they still lost the World Series, in theory, because of their bullpen. Bullpens have always been terrible. They always will be terrible.
You know, I was reading about the other day, it doesn't matter why, Bases Loaded, the video game for the NES, and they broke down all the teams. They obviously didn't have a major league license, so they just had these made-up teams with made-up player names on it. Anybody listening to this is aware of Bases Loaded, obviously. And I was just reading this breakdown of all the teams, trying to like remember some of them. You know, they were all pretty – they had some weaknesses and strengths, some had powerful offenses, terrible bullpens. And they did a pretty good job balancing it out. One team has like a terrible bullpen, but also has the best reliever in the game. So like it's just different stuff like that to make it a different experience every time. You know, this was the height of technology whenever this game came out, 1980 something, maybe. My point is that's just not how real life looks in baseball. Like, it's not like every team has a different strength and a different weakness. When you break down the NL East, it's, you know, it's almost like that article didn't even need to be written with anonymous scouts. You're basically like, yeah, these teams have good lineups when they're healthy, but all their bullpens suck and none of them have been able to rely too much on their starting pitching. And that's a pretty much a summary of every one of these teams' seasons so far. They've been hurt by injury, their starting pitching hasn't been reliable, and their bullpen has sucked, because that's what happens a lot of the time. It's not, you know, there's not a lot of balance out there. It's a lot of the same kind of stuff because everybody's trying to play the same game kind of the same way at this point. So it's not as interesting as an 8-bit video game would have you believe. So in 2009, about this time, Chase Utley was hitting almost 350. And after hip surgery, there had been some concerns about him coming back in 2009. Because this was a time when we were scared of stupid, silly things, Liz, like Chase Utley not being able to hit 350. But then he got hit in the right foot and was kept out of this game against the Cardinals as a precautionary method, and we got worried all over again. But the Phillies beat the Cardinals 10-7 and stayed on a roll, heading out after two games to Flushing for more action against the Mets. And this time, they were set to face Johan Santana for the first time of the season, who I'm sure you remember and love remembering the Phillies playing against. This was headline news at the time. I'm sure you remember. The previous year, the Mets ace had finished third in Cy Young voting with a 2.53 ERA. This season was close to the end of his career, but he put up good numbers again and would be an all-star. In three starts against the Phillies, he'd have an even 3 ERA in 21 innings. He feasted on the Marlins that year, striking out 20 of them in 14 innings. But yeah, the Mets acquiring Santana was supposed to be what gave them the edge over the Phillies. And while that never materialized, the edge, I mean, facing Johan Santana was never fun when you were the Phillies in this era. He was never the guy you wanted to face. And frankly, the Phillies were lucky that they hadn't faced him yet this season. So in response, in this game, the Phillies started Chan Ho Park, who was in the rare position of potentially losing his job, as you remember, once Charlie Manuel whispered whatever secret password he and Rich Doobie had established in Rich Doobie's ear. The Phillies, of course, lost this game, but not in the way you'd expect. Park and Santana went frame for frame for six innings, the only difference being that Santana's ERA was about 6 points lower than Park's. I believe it was 0 point something at this point in the season. Smelling a rare chance for offense after a leadoff ground rule double from Raul Ibanez after the sixth inning, Charlie Manuel yanked Park and put in pinch hitter Eric Bruntlett. That obviously didn't work, and now the Phillies had to go to their bullpen in a 0-0 game, which of course led to the game's only run scoring for the Mets on a weak ground ball to third base and a throwing error on Pedro Feliz. So the Mets won 1-0 because their offense managed to squeak one past the Phillies' beleaguered fifth starter while relying on their ace to keep the thunderous offense at bay. Kind of a hilarious and frustrating way to lose for this team. But the following night was far less interesting, as Jamie Moyer got pounded for 4 runs in the first and 7 total before being lifted for Jay Happ after 2 1/3 innings. The bullpen actually kept the Mets off the board for the rest of the game, and the offense crawled back into it after a 7-0 deficit, but couldn't do better than a 7-5 loss. So Phillies scuffling a little bit in early May, once again, as the story was for the last month of the 2009 Phillies season, the back half of the month is where they found a lot of their success after struggling. What's interesting they played the Mets in 4 of these 6 games we've talked about. So really interesting, it's not really interesting, kind of funny Mets tidbit from this era. In early May 2009, the Mets actually banned copies of two of their local tabloids, the New York Post and the Daily News. And I read this at first, like they banned reporters from those outlets from covering the Mets. That's not what they did. They banned copies of those newspapers from being provided for players in the Citi Field clubhouse. I'll just read this, this paragraph from New York Magazine at the time. "So as not to expose the team to what one source calls the bad vibes emanating from the local tabloids, the Mets will no longer provide copies of the Post or Daily News in the Citi Field clubhouse. This is considerably easier than ceasing to produce cause for said bad vibes. Officially, they say they'll now only provide USA Today so as not to play favorites among the local papers."
Awesome. Oh, that's so stupid.
"Awesomely," and I'm no supporter of these tabloids in New York, but their response was pretty terrific. "Awesomely, this story was reported by the Post under the headline, quote, 'Sensitive Mets won't be reading this mean old story,' which apparently isn't even as good as their original choice," which provides a link to the original story, which is, of course, you know, long gone, lost to the vapor of old internet. But yeah, I mean, that's exactly what you'd expect, honestly, from a New York tabloid who was just told of that news, that the team was like, "La la la, not listening, la 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 la." So that was the state of the Mets at that point, which is, you know, encouraging. But yeah, I mean, you know, this is just another example how cyclical baseball is. Every year we're pretty much talking about the same issues. You know, when's the last time you got to talk about a team with a good bullpen, Liz? Seriously, when was that? I mean, day to day, every bullpen seems to change whether it's good or bad. And I think we went into this season thinking, oh, David Robertson, Sir Anthony Dominguez. But, you know, once again, this is a team that's not relying too much on the back of its rotation, can't rely too much on its bullpen, even though they've shown flashes of brilliance. It's just 10 years gone, and it feels like we're talking about the same thing. So I don't know. Let's end on a more interesting question. Liz, if you were going to ban any media outlet from your team's clubhouse, not the reporters, but the paper itself, what would you go with? And not a paper necessarily. It could be, obviously, it's 2019, a website or anything.
That's a question. Wow. Mm-hmm. The entire world of media is opened up in front of me while being aware that I'm also technically part of it.
I'm going to go with Yahoo Sports.
I'm going to ban my own entity, Yahoo Sports. I'm kidding. I love everyone at Yahoo Sports. I love my overlords, Verizon Media Group. Thank you, Verizon, for allowing me to live. I mean, one of my least favorite media outlets is 538. I think they do really bad work.
Oh, that's
in general. I'm not a Nate Silver fan, but to my knowledge, they don't actually walk into clubhouses. You see, Fangraphs has gotten so much better since Meg Rowley started. I love Meg and what she's done with Fangraphs. I don't know. Could I ban John Heyman? I don't even know if he walks into clubhouses anymore.
I don't think you need to.
Lawn chair in Florida.
I was gonna say a car parked outside the stadium, but that's probably a little too hands on. I think you're
maybe it's USA Today and Bob Nightingale who just can't get anything right.
I don't want to sound mean spirited. My least we have friends who have worked for this entity, and I get what it's for. I get that it's supposed to be more playful. It's MLB trying to embrace like interneting, but I can't, and I don't think it's for me, which is part of the issue. So, but I can't get on board with Cut 4, MLB's like cutesy internet blogging wing of its coverage.
I have so many friends who work there. I have like a lot of people. We both know people who work there, yes. And they try hard.
Yes, I don't have any problem with any particular person at Cut 4. I just, as an entity, I mean, sometimes they'll just put something up that was like, I remember having to post stuff like that. And yep. It doesn't feel good. Like, I think yesterday they posted a ranking of like top ballpark foods posted like, you know, in relation to pretty much nothing. And the ranking was just like 13 different things that someone had thought of off the top of their head. And like not even a full sentence fragments provided for each reasoning that was, again, completely arbitrary. I mean, it was just kind of like, oh, boy, it's the kind of stuff that feels like junk mail just showing up in your mailbox. And you're just like, why? But on the same note, it's not like, you know, you figure you ban a particular outlet from your clubhouse to avoid negative coverage getting in your players' heads. I don't think Cut 4 would ever air something so negative that it would get banned from a clubhouse. No. It's a matter of personal taste. And like I said, it's just not for me at this point in my fandom. It's probably for a younger crowd that's on the internet all day long and just wants to see funny headlines and quirky stuff about baseball. And that's, you know what? I like learning that Clint Frazier put his mother's cats on his cleats. Like, that's great. What? I do like that information is out there. But sometimes it just reaches that level where you're just like, why are we doing any of this?
I'm
this
not asking ridiculous. Any more questions about that.
Well, on that note, we'll wrap up the latest episode of Continued Success. Don't forget to subscribe, download, and rate all the podcasts that are part of the Good Fight podcast family. Hit and Season with John Stolness, The Dirty Inning with myself and Dr. Trevor Strunk, and of course, Continued Success with me and Liz Rocher. We'll be back next week talking what happened next for the 2009 Phillies, as well as whatever's going on with our current 2019 Phillies. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time on Continued Success.